We are looking at this familiar Christmas story that we've heard so many times through our lives, and we're trying to look at it freshly from Joseph's perspective. That's why you see the props up here to sort of look like a carpenter's shop, because that was Joseph's trade. And we want to find out a little bit more about this story by thinking about what this would have been like for Joseph to do the work that he's done. And ultimately, you know, I hope I learn more about God by for sure coming to know his son that came as a child so humbly. But I also believe I can get to know him more fully by understanding how he worked through other people that played such an integral part of this story, Joseph. And I think it would have been so strange for Joseph at the time. And, you know, it's so easy for us to, you know, we're 2,000 years after the story. We know what happens next. We know what the child does and what he becomes and what the sacrifice was about and how the church has built based on that story. And, you know, that's our vantage point. But to try to go back and try to understand what it would have been like in that moment for this man is tricky, and I think it's rich with our understanding as we delve into that. What would have that been like? I've got a commercial I want us to take a look at here. I think you've seen it before, but Raleigh, go ahead and roll that one. Maybe.
Group. I wore lederhosen. When I first got on Ancestry, I was really surprised that I wasn't finding all of these Germans in my tree. I decided to have my DNA tested through Ancestry DNA. The big surprise was we're not German at all. 52% of my DNA comes from Scotland and Ireland. So I traded in my lederhosen for a kilt.
Have you seen that one? It's for Ancestry.com, and I love that at the end. He said he traded his lederhosen for a kilt. He thought he was German. That's where he started doing his German dancer at the beginning, and he found out that he was actually more Scottish, and so he traded that in for a kilt. And what that's about is you can swab your cheek and get some DNA and send it in, and they'll give you a report. You know, what's your DNA profile will show what your ancestry's like. And you know, there's this demand. People want to study their genealogies. They want to go back and they want to find out where they are at with this. And boy, with, you know, all the computers and stuff that we have, with the internet, it makes it so easy to do these ancestry type searches. You don't have to do the DNA thing they're selling, but you can go back and you can find your heritage, your genealogy of where you came from. And you know, we always got the weird uncle and the crazy cousin when you do that. You know, they're out there and they're part of our heritage. What does this have to do with the nativity story? It has a lot, because as Matthew tells this story, Joseph also had his genealogy traced. He knew what his heritage was, and we can see this as we go to the very first chapter of Matthew. And we read here, I'm just going to pull a little bit out of this, starting in verse 14. You know, I'm sure these are some of your favorite parts of the Bible to read, you know, especially in the Old Testament, and you go to all these long genealogies, you know, they begat, you know, all this kind of stuff. Well, again, in the New Testament, Matthew does this to give a little bit of background on where Joseph comes from, and here's a portion of it. It says, "And Azor was the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Achim, and Achim the father of Eliud, and Eliud the father of Eleazar, and so on." And then we get to Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Messiah. The people of Israel were meticulous about keeping track of these genealogies. It was part of what they did. They had these just storehouses full of genealogical records of families. It was important to them to know what tribe they came from and who owned what land and who was fit to serve in temple practice and so forth. A lot of these records were kept. And so that happened in respect to Joseph's background. And they didn't have DNA, and they didn't have computers, and they didn't have internet. They did it. It was all done with scribes and writing, and they kept track of all of these kinds of records. And so I can't help but wonder, you know, I think Joseph probably would have known about his background. He would have known about this probably, because they had to get those records from somewhere. And he probably would have known about, you know, yeah, my dad was Jacob and so on, and worked its way back. And I think if he did, Hannah's song would have made even more sense, because this question about why me? Because I think as he would go back and look at his genealogy, there would be some questions. Because if you go back a little bit further, I want to show a little bit more of this genealogy here. And this comes from earlier in the chapter here. And it starts off and says, Abraham, Father Abraham, he's the start of the Israel people. Abraham is the beginning of this genealogy, was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob. And Judah on down here, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And we keep going down here, and I'm not going to read all these, but I want you to know I've got some of them highlighted. I've got Tamar highlighted, I have Rahab highlighted, Ruth and the wife of Uriah, whose name was Bathsheba. Those are yellow. And I highlight those because I think this is so curious that this is included inside of Joseph's genealogy, which is part of Jesus, the Messiah. This is on record of all these people that are there. And those yellow ones to me are fascinating that they are included. Well, one, they're women. All of those yellow ones are women there. And you know, back in the good old days, women didn't count. I'm kidding there. Okay, those weren't the good old days. But literally, they didn't count then. They didn't. They weren't part of, you know, they weren't part of stuff. So to have women listed is very interesting that they would do that. But when you look at the history of these women, it even gets more fascinating. Tamar, the first one listed up there, is the daughter-in-law of Judah, who dresses up as a prostitute to seduce her father-in-law so that she would become pregnant. And she does, and that's why we have her listed there as the children that comes. Wow. And you go on, you have Rahab, who was a prostitute at Jericho that helped the spies when they came in, a prostitute that was there that later married, is it Samuel, I think, that maybe she's married to. And you go on down to Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth. Whole book written on Ruth. Ruth is from Moab, or a Moabite, which was looked down upon by the Israel people. They were kind of the second class that were not supposed to associate. They lived on the other side of the tracks, you know, don't go marrying those Moabites. Stay away from them. But she's included there. And then the wife of Uriah, if you remember that story, this is David. David's out hanging out, and he looks and he sees Bathsheba, who is bathing out on the roof somewhere, and they hook up and have this adulterous affair and have a child, and that child dies, but then later on they go on to have the child Solomon. You know, wow. And those four women are listed there. They're not what you would typically think of these people that are in royal lineage of the Messiah. They got some junk, don't they? And some dirt. You know, it's interesting that they're there. It's interesting that they are included. And you know, a lot of people think that are non-believers, non-followers of Christ, that, you know, these guys concocted this story up in the, you know, 3rd and 4th century. They started putting these things together to make this religion called Christianity. You know, if I'm going to make up a religion, and I'm going to talk about the people that are going to be in the background of Joseph, who's going to raise the king, if I'm going to make it up, am I going to put in, get me? I would put those people in there. They're kind of colored there a little bit. They're yellow. But they've got this past. They've got stuff going on. I wouldn't make it up that way. And so Joseph, as he looks at this and he knows who he comes from and he knows what his background is, why me? But I'm not one to second guess what angels have to say. But man, this is a strange way to save the world. What a strange way to save the world, to have these people part of Joseph, the man chosen to be Jesus' stepfather, that's going to bring him up and to teach him how to be a man. Adam Hamilton, the book that we are using here called Faithful Christmas Through the Eyes of Joseph, talks about this. And he says, you know, those people that are there that are listed that have questionable character and questionable past says this, ultimately God used them, blessed them, and blessed their offspring, and they became part of God's redemptive work in the world. And I thought that was really good what he said. Those people were there, And for sure he knows their past. For sure he knows what they did. For sure he knows where they came from. But yet he used them as part of his big redemptive plan. So this story goes as we pick up where Joseph is involved in this birth narrative of our Christ in verse 18 of the first chapter of Matthew. And it says this. Now the birth of Jesus the Messiah took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been engaged to Joseph, but before they lived together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. Her husband Joseph, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly. Familiar story that we have here. I've got some marks up there right before verse 19, some asterisks in there, because, you know, Matthew, I think, leaves some stuff out. You know, here we have Mary, who has not been intimate with Joseph. They are engaged, but they are not married, and they have not been intimate together. And she's found to be with child. And then we go right into 19, and it says what Joseph's response would be. And, you know, something happened in between there, because what's left out there is Mary had to tell Joseph for him to know. And how did he initially react to this? Well, guys, this is probably a little easier for you to think a little bit about, from being a human, what this would be like. Mary comes to you and says, Joseph, I know we're planning to get married. I know we've never been together. We've never been intimate, but I'm pregnant. And the child is from the Holy Spirit. How did he respond? And it goes right into what it says here. It says, her husband Joseph, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly, to divorce her. Wow, what really happened there? Well, Adam Hamilton provides a little bit of background, a little bit on how marriages work. They're different than how they work today. To be engaged was a legal thing. There was a document that said Mary and Joseph are going to be married. It was a legal thing. And there was a document that they had prepared. And there was also money that the groom's family provided to the bride and the bride's family. The groom's family would come up with a chunk of money. They estimated to be about what a small house would be. And the groom's family or father gave that to the bride's family or father. Similarly, the groom would have money that would be given to the bride. And that's already done. That is part of the engagement process here. And that has been done. And it's substantial. It's some serious cash. And that has been done. He goes on to say, I want to share this, but I can't read it. I can't express it any better than what he has. So I want to read a section from this book that tells you a little bit about what that meant and what this means about Joseph and what he did and what his response really means. He says, the engagement was legal, the money had been given, but Joseph undoubtedly felt utterly betrayed and humiliated. Once Mary became visibly pregnant, people were going to talk. Joseph faced a dilemma. On the one hand, he could do what was customary in such circumstances and call off the marriage. He would have to go to the priest or to the public square and declare what had happened and why he was breaking off the engagement. To do this publicly would be to call Mary out as an adulteress. She would be publicly scorned and humiliated as the women listed in the genealogy were. Tamar and Rahab and so on. The law of Moses stipulates an even harsher penalty for an engaged woman who cheats on her bridegroom before they are married. The city's elders will bring the young woman to the door of her father's house. The citizens of that city must stone her until she dies, because she has betrayed the man to whom she was engaged, her entire family, and God. Remove such evil from your community, says the law. Now, it doesn't appear that this penalty was practiced much among Jewish people under Roman rule at this time. But even if Mary were not put to death, she would be seen as a sinner in her community, a harlot, like Rahab. And she would be viewed this way from that time forward. Few men would consider marrying a woman who had cheated on her fiancé. The money would be returned to Joseph and his family. Mary would carry a reputation with her from then on. Her family, too, would have faced disgrace. But that was not what Joseph wanted. Instead, even though undoubtedly heartbroken, he showed mercy to Mary. He decided to divorce her quietly. This likely meant that he would say he had changed his mind about that marriage. As it became evident that Mary was pregnant, people would assume that Joseph was the father and that he had a change of heart after being intimate with her. He, not Mary, would be seen as the dishonorable party in the relationship. He would take all the blame. He would accept the stigma and shame for himself rather than allow Mary to be forever disgraced. Mary and her family would keep the money as child support and alimony. Her dignity would remain intact. No one would be put to death. All this implied by those few words in Matthew's gospel, Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man. And we know now why, because what that would have meant. He didn't want to humiliate her. He decided to call off their engagement quietly. Isn't that remarkable about what Joseph did there, that he decided to quietly divorce her? It was an act of honor. He didn't want her to be disgraced. He felt compassion for Mary. He showed mercy. He showed forgiveness and grace. That's in his character. He felt hurt and betrayed, but refused to denounce her publicly and humiliate her. That is remarkable. And that's why Matthew says Joseph was a righteous man. God saw something in this man he could use in his redemptive plan for all of humankind. The character and nature of Joseph. The story goes on then if we go to verse 20. But just when he had resolved to do this, to divorce Mary, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She'll bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. So he has this dream. This dream that tells him what is really going on. Did he get it? What if he understood this? What if he had peace with this? What have I, the rest of you guys, if that would have happened, what would your reaction be? My daughter is really pregnant right now. She is due in just a few weeks here, Jenna and her husband Matt. This is their first. Have I talked about my grandkids in here very much? And she'll be, I really haven't done that too much. Brag on them a little bit. But this makes it kind of a neat time, especially to be this late in a pregnancy during this time of the year. And so it's caused them to look at the nativity afresh, a little new, that these brand new parents, it's their first child, you know, and what this means. And I'm going to share a little bit more about how this all came about, but I wanted to kind of milk them a little bit to get their perspective on a young couple and a child and what this would mean. And so I've been talking with Matt a little bit about what this would mean for a young man to be a father. And we talked here about this dream, and he wrote me some stuff that I want to share with you about. Here's Joseph, the situation that he's in, and Gabriel comes and tells him what we just read there. And so Matt writes this. He says, imagine you are in his shoes, Joseph's. He must feel humiliated. He's a well-respected carpenter and a man in love. He then learns of this news. Now he's lying in bed one day when Gabriel visits him in a dream and tells him much the same story he likely heard from Mary. We see this as an affirmation of Mary's story in the context of studying the Bible, but imagine if that was you. I know I would wake up and feel like what Mary had told me earlier in the day must have affected my dreams. But that's not what Joseph thought, and that's not how he treated his experience. He believed it was divine, the work of God. He woke up and took Mary as his wife, promising to raise this son of man. That is faith. The birth of Jesus does not happen without God having chosen these two specific individuals. He chose Mary to bear and raise Jesus while at the same time choosing Joseph to teach and protect him while he grows up. Christmas is a reminder of not only Jesus' birth and God's gift to his people that will ultimately be played out in the life and teachings of his son, but it's a reminder of what family is and what a family who has faith in God can and will do. Mary never stopped saying yes to God or to Joseph. She believed in the calling of her and Joseph's family. Joseph never stopped caring for Mary or raising Jesus up the right way. He believed in the mission of his son. They were a family of faith in God. A family of faith in God. And that's really what this is so much about, this two-way street of faith that is revealed in how Mary and Joseph reacted. God is faithful. What he said he would do, he did. He is a faithful God. What he said he would do, he did. Clear back in Genesis, when we all messed up in Genesis 3, and we fell short, and we chose sin, and we chose our own way, we're divided. Sin separated us from God, you and me, and all of humankind. But God says, no, I don't want that. You people are my prized possession, and I want to be back in communion with you. And so as early as chapter 3, he says this. This is the statement that he makes, this promise to that serpent. He, this one that will come, will strike your head and you will strike his heel. That is the first of this promise that we're going to take care of the effects of this sin that the serpent has caused. One will come that will strike your head and you will strike his heel. Later on then in his plan, he's going to do this redemptive plan, this reconciliation of humans to himself through a people that starts with Abraham. And he says to Abraham in verse 12, I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I'll curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. A promise to Abraham that I'm going to restore all of humankind from way back then till 2017 and on through Abraham. And again to David in 2 Samuel, David, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever. Before me, your throne shall be established forever. Those are his promises. I'm going to do this, starting in Genesis. I'm going to do this, and it's going to culminate with the Christ child. And how did he do that? Is he faithful? Well, go back to that lineage. He said he was going to do it through Abraham. Where did Matthew's genealogy start to Joseph? Abraham was the father of Isaac, was the father of Jacob. And on down the road, Obed was the father of Jesse, was the father of David. And on down the road, where it says, and Jacob was the father of Joseph, who was the husband of Mary, who bore the son Christ. What he says he will do, he did. He did through that lineage, through Christ, through all of that history throughout time. God is faithful. What he said he would do, he did. But God is also faithful. What he says he will do, he will do. So many promises for us. So many promises for us. The one I selected here comes from John chapter 9. Jesus says this. Here's this promise. I am the gate. Whoever enters by me will be saved. I came that you may have life, and you may have it abundantly. An abundant life here, because that is a life that's played out as an integral part of God's plan for redeeming all people. That's what makes our life so abundant, to be a part of this redemptive plan that we see played out throughout history. Yeah, but you know, I'm just a small businessman from Roanoke, or a farmer, or I'm retired, or I'm a student, or I'm a widow, or I don't have any skills, and I don't have any influence, and I've got a past, and I've got problems. Can't be part of the plan? Well, so did Joseph, and so did David, and so did Solomon and Bathsheba and Rahab and Tamar and Ruth. They all did. But ultimately, as Adam and Hamilton said, God used them, blessed them, and blessed their offspring, and they became part of God's redemptive work in the world. God is faithful. They were faithful. It's our time to be faithful as well and find our role in God's redemptive plan. Let's pray.